Hey, Morbidology listeners. Before we get on with today's episode, could I please request that you don't judge Morbidology on the early episodes? I'd recommend maybe listening from the newer ones backwards, because I honestly didn't find my feet in podcasting for quite some time. The quality of the early episodes, as well as the hosting, is not a true representation of Morbidology today, and I'm currently in the process of redoing them all. If you do listen to the earlier episodes, please don't judge the show on them, and maybe give a newer one a listen before deciding if the show is for you. Thank you so much for all of your support, and now on with the show. Welcome to Morbidology. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, Mysteries Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Join Morbidology on Patreon for exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, exclusive merch, ad-free and early release episodes, and much more. In 1984, Ferntree Gully in Melbourne, Australia was rocked by the brutal murder of a single mother and her young daughter. A mix-up in forensic evidence has resulted in the case tragically becoming a cold case. 35 years later, and investigators are no closer to uncovering what actually happened. Shauna Tapp was a 9-year-old student at Ferntree Gully's Wattleview Primary School. She lived at 13 Kelvin Drive, Ferntree Gully, Melbourne, Victoria, Australia, with her mother, Margaret Tapp. Margaret and Shauna's father, Don Tapp, had divorced back in 1979, and as a single mother, Margaret was very protective of her young daughter. Typically, she wouldn't even let Shauna go to her friends' houses after school. Shauna was a bright and beautiful little girl. Those who knew her said that she had a wonderful sense of humour and was always smiling. Margaret was a particularly attractive woman with fiery red hair and an enchanting smile. She easily made a wide circle of friends at Box Hill and Ferntree Gully hospitals, where she had worked as a nurse. Then in 1981, Margaret became a law student at Monash University, which widened her friend circle even further. She was an extremely ambitious woman and was always aiming higher to provide the very best life for her family. It was a warm and quiet afternoon in the suburbs on the 8th of August, 1984, when Tony Blackwell, a young man dating Margaret's sister, called to the Tapp household. He picked up the newspaper in the driveway and knocked on the front door. When there was no answer, he wrote a note and left it on the porch. He felt perplexed that Margaret's car remained in the driveway, yet it appeared as though nobody was home. Nevertheless, he thought that nothing was awry and left. Several hours later, at around 6 p.m, a friend of Margaret named Jim Rowlands came around to the house. He and Margaret were planning on going on a date that evening to the opera. On the way to the opera, they had planned on dropping Shauna off at the babysitter's. When Margaret didn't answer, he opened the back sliding door and walked inside. What Jim found next scarred him for life.
Her car was in the driveway and I parked in behind it and went up to the door and everything was in darkness and it was unexpected. I immediately thought that there was something very wrong because Margaret and I had confirmed just the night before that I would be there at 6 o'clock to pick Shauna and her up. I just felt that there was something wrong.
In Margaret's bedroom, he found her lying in bed beside a book that she had been studying. Her body was pale and cold to the touch. It was evident that Margaret was dead. He later said that he had hoped that Margaret had committed suicide, and that Shauna was staying overnight at a friend's house. Sadly, however, she wasn't. He found Shauna's body in her own bed. Like her mother, she too was pale and cold to the touch. Jim rushed downstairs and called the police before calling Margaret's sister, Joan. An autopsy concluded that Margaret had been beaten and strangled to death, while Shauna had been raped and then strangled to death. Fibers found on their necks indicated that the killer had asphyxiated them both with a rope. It was determined that Margaret and Shauna were killed sometime between 10 p.m. and midnight, and presumably Margaret was killed first so that she couldn't protect her daughter. Since there was no sign of forced entry, it was theorized that Margaret had either known the killer and let him come in, or he had known the family well enough to know that the back door had a broken latch which could not be locked. Nothing in the house appeared to be stolen, and there was no sign of a struggle.
The bedroom was darkness, and I switched on the light and immediately thought, oh, she's fallen asleep. And I laid my hand to waken her, and as I did that, I saw a mark on her neck, a strangulation mark. She was dead, and somebody had killed her.
In 1984, DNA technology was non-existent. At the time, fingerprints were the best investigative tool. A number of fingerprints were found inside the home, but they were all eliminated because they had belonged to friends or family members who had been in the home in the run-up to the murders. There were no unidentified fingerprints, meaning that the killer had been extremely lucky or extremely careful. Investigators found two different hair types on Shauna's clothing and bedclothes. A long blonde hair and shorter grey ones that may have been tinted by dye. A search of the home also turned up ripple sole footprints from a Dunlop Volley sand shoe. The prints were left behind by the killer as he walked across papers that Margaret had spread across the floor while studying. While DNA testing was not yet developed, a semen sample was retrieved from Shauna's nightgown and underwear. In the wake of the murders, police asked the public for their assistance in searching for the killer. They urged anybody that had seen anything suspicious or out of the ordinary to call them immediately. One neighbour said that they had heard a muffled scream at around 11 p.m, and several neighbours said that they had heard the Taps dog barking frantically around midnight, but said that they didn't think anything of it at the time. Other neighbours reported that they had spotted a suspicious red utility Ford car parked up the street on the day of the murders. The shocking double murder put the town on edge. This was a sex crime that had been committed by a man who then murdered to cover up his sexual obsession for young girls. Even more alarming, he was still roaming the streets. Mark Elshaw, who was a classmate of Shauna, recalled how he and a number of other local children would ride their bikes around town, hoping that they would find a clue that would lead to the killer of their classmate and her mother.
There were no signs of forced entry, nothing stolen, and no evidence of violence. Yet sometime on Tuesday night or early yesterday morning, Margaret Christine Tapp and her 9-year-old daughter Shauna were strangled in their beds. Their bodies were discovered in separate bedrooms yesterday evening when a family friend went to the house in Kelvin Drive to escort Mrs. Tapp to the opera. Today, Homicide Squad detectives and forensic experts went over the house in search of fingerprints and other clues, and also interviewed Mrs. Tapp's neighbours about her movements.
In 1986, the Victorian government offered a $50,000 reward for information, but with very little tips, the case eventually went cold. The case didn't garner as much attention as the Easy Street murders or the disappearances of the Beaumont children. While these cases became worldwide folklore, the Tapp case faded into obscurity. Some believe that this was because of the confronting nature of the crime, that 9-year-old Shauna had been sexually assaulted and then killed.
But 2 years on, police still can't answer many key questions surrounding their deaths. Although several people have been interviewed, no one has ever been charged with murder, the motive for the murders is unclear, and police don't know whether they were premeditated.
There was one person, however, who carried the case around in his heart, Justin Tapp. Justin was the son of Margaret and the brother of Shauna. He was just 14 years old when the murders occurred. On that fateful night, he had been staying overnight with his grandparents. And while Justin wasn't strangled to death like his mother or like his sister, he was slowly suffocated by the horror of what happened that night. He was haunted by the memories and the thought that if he were home that night, then maybe the murders wouldn't have happened. Just a teenage boy himself at the time, he was old enough to blame himself for somebody else's vile actions that night. Over the forthcoming years, Justin's demons cost him his career and his marriage. He was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder and depression. In a bid to lull the pain, Justin turned to drink. He ended up alone and unemployed in a dingy apartment north of London. A neighbour later recalled, "Justin did not wish to be bothered by the outside world. It's just a shame he lived in isolation, but with that kind of trauma in his past, it's really no wonder." On the 3rd of June, 2014, Justin's ex-wife found him dead in his apartment.
He'd been having the sort of adolescent fights, as you do with your mum, but he never got a chance to make it right and fix it. So, you know, for him, it was tough.
His body was so badly decomposed that the pathologist couldn't determine whether or not he had committed suicide or accidentally drank himself to death. Now let's go back to 2005. It was this year that an improvement in DNA technology allowed forensic examiners to use the weak DNA sample that had come from semen stains left on Shauna's nightgown and underwear for elimination purposes. The quality of the sample wasn't good enough to be used as evidence for a conviction, nor could it be run through the DNA database in the hopes of getting a random match. Nevertheless, it was able to rule out a number of suspects and persons of interest. Jim Rowlands, the man who found the bodies, and Tony Blackwell, who knocked on the door before the bodies were discovered, were both ruled out as suspects. Other persons of interest who were ruled out included a former police officer who had stayed with Margaret shortly before her murder, a local doctor who had been having an affair with Margaret, and Margaret's own brother, Lindsay Nelson. Then in 2008, it was announced that the DNA evidence in the Tapp case was being retested in the hopes that improved methods could lead to a better quality DNA sample. Lo and behold, shortly thereafter, it was discovered that the retesting provided a full DNA profile. Russell Gisa was subsequently arrested and charged with the murders after he came back as a match for the DNA.
This was an arrest police thought they'd never make. 43-year-old Russell Gisa in the custody of Homicide Squad detectives investigating the 1984 deaths of Margaret Tapp and her 9-year-old daughter Shauna. Homicide detectives began their reinvestigation of the case back in 1999, but say it was the significant development of DNA technology in the last 6 months which allowed them to make today's arrest.
We've had a breakthrough in DNA, and as a result of that breakthrough, he was identified and linked to the scene.
Police will allege the 43-year-old struck at random and had no apparent connection to his victims.
Finally, it was the big break in the case. Or so it seemed. Just several weeks later, after receiving abundance praise for seemingly cracking the case, police withdrew the charge because of DNA contamination of evidence. A Victorian Police Forensic Services Centre review found that clothing with Russell's DNA from an unrelated case had been examined on the same day and on the same surface as the clothing from the Tapp case. This left open the possibility of contamination between the two tests. Other than the DNA found at the scene, which is now contaminated, there was little evidence other than a Dunlop Volley sand shoe footprint. It was a grim reminder that DNA evidence is not infallible, and the blunder forced the abandonment of the cold case, and the charges against Russell were dropped.
Assistant Commissioner Simon Overland delivered the news about the lab bungle that's rocked the justice system. Police have dropped murder charges against Victorian prisoner Russell Gisa in relation to the deaths of Margaret and Shauna Tapp. Detectives celebrated a cold case breakthrough using DNA evidence, but the lab bungle involving possible cross-contamination means it's back to square one.
We deeply regret the development in this case and would like to apologise to all concerned.
In the wake of the blunder, Victoria Police had to search through thousands of case files for possible contamination of evidence. This wasn't the first case during which DNA evidence was contaminated. Another high-profile case was the murder of one-year-old Jaden Leskey. It was found that unrelated DNA from a rape victim was found on the toddler's clothing during a 2003 check of the centre's DNA database. Russell sued the state of Victoria along with several current and former police employees. The murder case was put back on the shelf until 10 years later. As the 34th anniversary rolled around in 2018, he came forward to relay his belief that it was his father who had committed the murders. He said that in the winter of 1984, he was just a young boy and his mother was pregnant. He said that his father was a well-known and professional local man, while his mother ran her own business from the family home. The young family lived in a grand home in the Dandenongs, just a short drive from Ferntree Gully, where Shauna and Margaret lived. The man said that his family was wealthy, often going on family holidays and ski trips. He said that due to his father's job, he was often in Angliss Hospital in Ferntree Gully, which was where Margaret had worked. He was tall, built, and frequently played tennis. A tennis regular said that at first he thought that the man was a man's man, but he later changed his mind. As it turned out, the man had a wandering eye. "Beware of the good-looking one," said a woman who met the man while working in the emergency room. Now you may be questioning why this son thought that his father was the man who killed Margaret and Shauna. Well, eventually the family broke down when it was finally revealed that his father was a child molester and predator. He preyed on children between 1974 and 1995, but with the help of an expensive lawyer, he dodged all of the charges against him except for one. The truth was exposed in a practitioner's board hearing in 1998, when it was revealed that the man had preyed on girls as young as four in his place of employment. Some of his victims were even the childhood friends of his own daughter. The son also made a point to acknowledge that his father always wore Dunlop Follies to play tennis. This man was never publicly identified, and as of yet, investigators have provided no update. Theories and persons of interest have abounded since the brutal murders. Margaret Tapp was a liberated young woman who was highly social and friendly. Therefore, there were a number of potential persons of interest and suspects in the case. Many theorised if it were one of Margaret's many acquaintances, maybe a classmate, a scorned lover, or a jealous wife. At the time of the murders, there had been a family who lived in Kelvin Drive, and Margaret let one of them mow the lawn and clean her car. A number of neighbours said that they worried about this because of the young man's odd behaviour and sexual deviancy. The man's sister lived in a caravan beside the house with a boyfriend that would later be charged with rape. None of the family members were ever ruled out as suspects. One long-running person of interest was Kay Bradkey Stevenson. Shortly before the murders, Kay had found evidence that her husband, John Bradkey, was having an affair with Margaret, including a sex tape. In fact, it was John who had purchased Margaret her home in Ferntree Gully, which the couple then used for romantic liaisons. Kay told the police that Margaret had showed up to her home and begged her husband to leave her, and that on one occasion, she threw a rock through their window and stripped naked before lying down on the lawn. Eventually, John decided that he was going to leave his wife, but fate had other plans. On the night that he told his wife he was leaving, he died in a car crash. Following his death, Kay attempted to gain ownership of Margaret's home, but Margaret ended up getting half of the home and then purchased the other half from John's estate. Investigators considered that Kay may have hired a paedophile friend of hers to kill Margaret and Shauna for revenge. Early on in the investigation, the phone lines of Kay and her friend were tapped, but investigators found nothing in the phone calls that would warrant an arrest. Kay passed away in 2018, but the paedophile who was never publicly named, still remains a person of interest. The paedophile's wife confessed to investigators that she believed her husband was involved in the murders. In addition, investigators have an affidavit sworn by Kay in 1995, in which she confessed that she had given the paedophile a so-called loan of $52,000.
30 years on, I really have no idea who did it, who murdered my sister and Shauna.
We didn't know who did it, and we knew that was still out there. I just never felt safe again. So probably for about a good 20 years, I still think about them pretty often. It's still pretty raw.
If there is anyone out there who knows something, I would hope they'd have the courage to come forward and tell whatever they know.
It would bring peace. We could get on with life.
DNA is hailed as the be-all and end-all of forensic science. But this case proves that DNA evidence is not infallible. It should have become one of Victoria's biggest unsolved murder stories. But it never did. The killer slipped through the cracks, and as the 35-year anniversary is fast approaching, it seems more likely than ever that the killer will take his secrets to the grave. Well guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy Morbidology and want exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, please feel free to join me on Patreon. You can join for as little as $1 a month and cancel any time. You can also sign up annually and save 15%. Big thank you to everybody who simply listened to an episode, commented on an episode, shared an episode. All of the support is very much appreciated. Also make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing day.